25 years ago, when I first walked into the home that I own today, I noticed the smell of my childhood. I'd grown up in old houses that had sweet and musty odor. After my mother died, I got an antique china cabinet that had been in the family since the early 1950s. When I open the doors today, I get a whiff of my girlhood. That sweet odor is full of powerful and happy memories. My guest, Toby Israel, is a founder and leading practitioner in the field of design psychology. She has a PhD in environmental psychology and says that we can use our past histories of places where we grew up to create productive and comfortable living and working environments. Toby Israel works as a consultant and a researcher, and she's got a book entitled Someplace Like Home, Using Design Psychology to Create Ideal Places. And Toby Israel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning. Very nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. And you write about in this book the home that you grew up in Eaglewood, New Jersey. Sound like a kind of a suburban tract house?
Yes, very much so.
And what was that house like for you? What are some of the memories that you have of that?
Well, it was a split-level house, and it was kind of a conventional home. Having said that, it was very nicely decorated by my mother, who was an interior designer for the whole time that we were growing up. The town itself was a very interesting town in North Jersey with very much a town center, very much a beautiful kind of Gothic high school there. So it was a very pleasant place to live.
You also talk about the fact that in many ways you saw yourself as a more counterculture person than the kind of person that might live in a house like this.
That's right. It was beautifully designed, beautifully decorated, but it was more conventionally decorated than perhaps would have been my taste. And particularly being a child of the 60s, I was very much into thinking about social issues, social awareness, and not just wanting to create an image, but trying to create places of substance as well.
You live in the Princeton area, bought a house, and I'm interested in the kinds of decisions that you made. Sometimes these are conscious, sometimes they're unconscious, about where you wanted to live and what kind of parallels you see to your youth.
Right. Well, I actually, interesting part of the story, when I was writing the book, or right after I got the contract to write the book, I had been living in England, came back to the United States, and all of a sudden found that the house I was renting the landlady wanted to reoccupy it. So I suddenly had to find my own home and think about what that meant. So I decided to write the book and look for my home as one and the same exercise. So there's an autobiographical strand that runs throughout the book. So I took myself through exercises that led me back to my childhood experience of place, and in particular thought about places in my childhood that I had loved being in. And in particular, I had my cousin's house, which was very close by, where we spent a couple of times a week after school playing with my other cousins. And that was kind of a more simple artisan's house. It was a ranch house that had big glass windows and beam ceilings, very informal. And it kind of resonated as the world of the arts and intellectuals that I wanted to associate myself with. And none of this was conscious,
but I was just drawn
to that kind of house.
And did you end up with a house that mirrors some of that, that has some of that same look and feel to it?
Well, interestingly, if you look in the book at my cousin's house from my past and my house from my present, they look almost identical.
Yeah.
In fact, if you
look
quickly, I don't
want to give too much away, but yes, go ahead.
If you look quickly, they seem almost the same house.
Mm-hmm. Which tells you that and this is not nostalgia.
Right. This is not nostalgia design. The idea is not to recreate these places as is. It's rather to look at the primal, satisfying essence of the most special places from your past and recreate them, as opposed, for example, to just mindlessly recreating perhaps a place that seems familiar, even if it was a place that you weren't comfortable with or hated, which happens as well.
Well, and I was talking about the house that I live in today and the kind of smells that it had, and it was such a powerful experience. As I just opened the door and I smelt my childhood, I also heard church bells, and I grew up on a school campus, and so there were always the sound of bells and things going off. So somehow those two sense associations had a lot to do with the kind of comfort that I felt within this house.
Yes.
Is that unusual, you think, to have it? It's almost like a nonverbal experience.
Right. I do something called an environmental guided fantasy, which takes people back to their experience of childhood place. And in it, I ask them to remember the place in a sensory way, not just the way it looked visually, but the smells, even the taste, because amazingly, a lot of people mention, the cooking in their grandmother's house and that kind of thing. And it is always amazing to me, and amazing also to the people that I'm working with, that they can sometimes remember these places in unbelievable sensory detail. It just stayed with them.
But that, of course, tells you then how powerful these memories are, and how powerful even some of these images and smells and things are, that you can just, you're right back there experiencing it.
Absolutely.
When you talk then about design psychology, and you talk about creating an environmental autobiography, mm-hmm. is that what you're talking about, which is to go back and try to remember, recreate, think about those things that had some important meaning to you as a kid?
Right. Well, the idea behind design psychology is that we all do have an environmental autobiography, which is our own very personal past history of place. And the idea is to explore this past history, because most people think about their autobiography but not their environmental autobiography. But we all have one. And so why not look to open this kind of treasure chest of past place experiences and think consciously about what places, again, held meaning and importance to you? And then based on that, think about the kind of place you're either looking for if you're home hunting, or seeking to create if you're doing redecorating or doing some kind of interior design.
Is it thinking about just the kind of light that might come in windows, whether you have big windows, little windows, slit windows? I mean, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, it's everything. I base my theory on the work of Abraham Maslow, a humanistic psychologist who many of your listeners may know. And he had this theory that we are all motivated to be what he called self-actualized whole human beings. And he said we can only get to that place if we satisfy a hierarchy of human needs, from physiological needs at the bottom to esteem needs at the top. And what I've done is kind of transpose this hierarchy to say that in a house that is completely satisfying, mm-hmm. you need to satisfy, yes, the need for shelter at the bottom, so you better look for a house where the roof doesn't leak. But then also you need to find a house that is psychologically fulfilling, socially fulfilling, aesthetic, and also a place to grow. So I take people who I work with through a series of 9 exercises that gets them to look at anything from, the street where they live or where they want to live, to the house, to even objects within the house and how they want to arrange them.
You also draw on some Jungian ideas, these sort of archetypal ideas that we all share, I guess, at least according to Jung.
Yeah. Right. Well, it's very interesting because he himself had a dream about his own growth in the form of dreaming about his house and how it grew and changed and so on. And some people believe that the house is a very kind of exact archetype of who we are as people. In fact, I was very influenced by someone named Claire Cooper Marcus, who also wrote a wonderful book called House's Mirror of Self, based on an article called House's Symbol of Self, where she says kind of person, who we are as people, the self, and the house are one. So as we develop ourself, we can think about that development as expressed through our house.
Well, it's interesting to also, when you get to be a certain age, you can look back on either the various houses that you have lived in, and Americans are very mobile,
right.
or just how the house that you have lived in for years changes over time, depending on whether the children are little or teenagers or gone, where you are in your own life as you live with your stuff.
Right. And one of the things that we see, for example, is older people very often have a very difficult time leaving the family home.
Yes.
Because it's a transition to a new way of life. It's not just the physical leaving the house behind or the furniture behind. It's everything that those things represent. So a wise thing to do, for example, if you're moving an elderly parent, is to be sure to think about what special things are in that house for that person that will keep that connection to self and place intact.
Do you think that for some people, living in a house, and if you have this sort of sense of either discomfort or doesn't quite work, there's something off about that.
Mm-hmm.
Does that tell you that it it might be interesting to take one of these psychological journeys to try to figure out what it is that feels so disconnected living in a house.
Well,
I think we've all experienced that in one way or another.
Yes. Well, I think it's a great thing to do. I mean, in today's day and age, we're bombarded with shelter magazines, design TV, telling us how places ought to look or should look or must look, rather than being encouraged to look at ourselves and, again, at our own experience of place and what is meaningful to us as individuals. So it's something that I really believe that people should do, not just people who are homeowners or renters or whatever, but also designers as they help people to understand that it isn't just a look, it's a place where people live and exist personally.
You know, sometimes we've all driven by these huge, as they're called, McMansions now that are going up all over the place. And you drive by and you just think, you know, what do people use all those rooms for? And I wonder whether having outsized houses like that creates a challenge when trying to create a comfortable, intimate, creative environment.
Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about those homes is very often they only use small portions of the home. They only use a kitchen to sit in, as I would use my kitchen, or you might use your kitchen as a social place, not just a place to cook. Or there would be a TV room when you have a huge living room that isn't used. So again, those kinds of things are about creating a certain image rather than having an authentic place to live.
I've often thought that if I could design a house, I would not have a dining room.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a room that's used, at least in my house, a couple times a year. Mostly we put laundry on it during the other days of the year. It's a great place for just dumping things. And it's interesting to think how that room has changed over time.
Right. Well, other kinds of exercises that I do are something called an environmental sociogram, where I have people not label houses according to an official label, like living room, dining room, kitchen, but label it according to, well, what is its use? And then kind of color it in, thinking about the public space, the private space, the semi-private space, really trying to understand how you use it as people within the house. And then based on that, think about redesigning that place.
Oh, that's interesting. So don't have something called a living room or a dining room. Try to, if you can do that, figure out how you actually live in the house and then call it whatever. Right.
Right. I mean, if you really use the dining room to eat and you have your dinner there and your guests there on a regular basis, great. But if you're using it for a laundry room, I would be asking, well, why? And is there some other way you can configure it?
And kitchens, I'm assuming this has always been the case, are the kind of heart of the house, the central part of the house?
Well, that's what research seems to show, that very often the kitchens are as much a social place as they are a place for eating or cooking.
And, of course, then you've got all the, you know, the warm feeling, the smells, the
that's
socializing,
right.
All the stuff that goes on. Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with our guest, Toby Israel. She's a founder leading practitioner in the field of design psychology. She's got a PhD in environmental psychology and joins us this morning on Radio Times to talk about how we think about where we live, drawing from childhood memories and experiences to create environments that are productive and comfortable for living and working today. Interested in some of the memories that you have about houses that you grew up in or neighborhoods that you grew up in, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Call us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
PhillyFunGuide.com with PNC Bank supports WHYY and offers complete listings of events such as new iPod tours of the galleries at Winterthur Museum in Winterthur, Delaware. The new iPod tours are narrated by Leigh and Leslie Kino, stars of PBS's Antiques Roadshow and Find. For information, the number is 1-800-448-3883. Winterthur Museum and Country Estate events and more on PhillyFunGuide.com.
I'm Mike McGrath. On the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll explain how gardeners new and old can maximize their growing space and minimize their growing work by building easy care raised beds this spring. Plus chemical-free answers to all your gardening questions. That's You Bet Your Garden this Saturday morning at 11 right here on WHYY 91 FM.
This week in This American Life, Catalina has a huge crush on an actor on an old TV show. Then one day, in her high school, she sees him walking down the hall. Except it's not him. And it's a girl.
The eyebrows, white skin, black hair, same nose, eyes, lips, and the same strong jaw. I went, oh my God.
Doomed love for Valentine's Day this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Toby Israel is our guest. She wrote a book called Someplace Like Home, using design psychology to create ideal places. And we're talking about some of the interesting psychological ideas associated with design and creating environments where people feel productive and comfortable and creative. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. This is a more psychological question, but as we all know, there are unfortunately too many people where the memories of childhood are unhappy memories, whether it's an abusive family or a bad divorce or parents that didn't get along or whatever. How do you suggest people think about those memories and experiences when thinking about how they want to live today?
Well, because of that, I think that's the reason why it's important to become more conscious of the unconscious influence of past place. If you have lived in a house where you were unhappy or uncomfortable, sometimes people just kind of mindlessly recreate that house because, again, it seems familiar. But by going through what I call the design psychology process, you can become more aware of things that you didn't like about a particular house or ways you don't want to be reminded of a particular house, so that you can more consciously choose to design or use design elements that are positive triggers for you.
It's familiar, but it's unhappy, or
exactly.
It's difficult, or even traumatizing.
Absolutely.
But what's familiar is the thing that we tend to go back to.
Right. And everybody's different. When I was house hunting, again, I went and looked at a split-level house, thinking, well, that was from my past. I might want to live there. But
right.
I kind of ran out. And again, it wasn't because I had an unhappy childhood, but my father was ill for many years. So to me, it reminded me a lot about my father's illness. So it was important for me to see why I didn't want that house in order to choose something else.
Do you think, though, people, and I'm thinking about how people might rearrange their furniture, do you think unconsciously people arrange their furniture kind of like the way it was when they grew up?
Yes, they do.
Yeah, I observe that.
I speak a lot about this around the country, and I work with people. And there's always that aha moment. In fact, as we're talking, there's probably people out there who are sitting there and saying, now that I think about
that's
it.
That's exactly how my parents had the sofas,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
the wing chairs.
Study is just like my grandmother's house.
But that's important, right? Because if you're unconscious about it, that means you've done something unconsciously. And what would be interesting is to try to figure out why you did it, right?
Yes. I mean, part of it is it's an expression of who you are in the present. It could also be messages that were sent to you from your family, from not only parents, but grandparents, great-grandparents, about how a house should or ought to be, and thus how you should or ought to be as a person. But, you know, perhaps the message was you should be a very formal, proper person.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we live in an age where people have the ability to be informal, so why not change that pattern? Sometimes it's a healthy thing to do, to change the pattern.
I do want to get to our callers, but you also talk about your grandparents who came from Hungary.
Right.
So there are sort of deep roots on this as well, showing even the kind of house that they might have grown up in or lived in.
Yes. One of the things I do is an environmental genealogy with people, where I ask them to literally take an environmental family tree and fill it out, describing homes of their ancestors. And when I was then renovating the kitchen in the house that I bought, I went back to that family tree and saw that really kitchen in my great-grandparents' kind of hut house in Hungary was a kitchen that I heard so much about. It was a place where there was lots of activity. It was very close-knit. There was an oven room where they baked fresh-baked bread and all kinds of other wonderful Hungarian things. And so that became part of the imaging that I did for what a kitchen would be in my present home, which would be a very close-knit place,
right,
and so on.
I mean, obviously it doesn't look anything like what
no.
your greater grandparents had, but created the same kind of feeling and environment. That's what you were looking for.
That's right, the essence of the place.
Well, let's get some callers in the conversation. We've got Elizabeth from Queen Village. Elizabeth, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, my question is, if you are in a home that you love in terms of the bones of the home, but now, in retrospect, years later, realize that perhaps it's not the most I don't know, healthy psychological environment in terms of interior design. Like, we're stuck with elements, you know, we live in the city, so light's always an issue, and, right, you know, the narrowness of the house, but we do love our location, and we do love the house as a whole. Is it possible to make it a more healthy, you know, psychologically healthy environment just through interior design, or we just have to, like, move?
Big question there. Go ahead.
Well, I think part of it is to say, well, what is it about the home that's making you uncomfortable? If it's just kind of physical elements like the light or the narrowness, well, obviously you can put more lighting in. You know, mm-hmm. you can do things that make rooms not feel as long and narrow. But what I would say is, you know, beyond that, is there something about that house that you bought so many years ago that's no longer working for you on a psychological level? Did it? What was the reason that you bought it in the first place? Do those reasons still stand, or are they different? So it's seeing what you can change kind of on the physical realm, but then digging a bit deeper to see what it is that the house holds for you now versus when you bought it.
And again, you know, people go through transitions in their life.
That's
where,
right.
Where things have different meanings. Elizabeth, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me get Bree from Newark, Delaware. Bree, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Well, I have a question about how you combine sort of two backgrounds. My fiance and I recently moved in together, and I grew up in a small town in North Idaho, and he grew up in the Bronx. So we have very divergent backgrounds in what we grew up in. How do you sort of meld those two to create a comfortable environment for both people to live in?
And I have to say, Toby Israel, the Delaware Valley is listening to your response to this question.
That is a great question. And, you know, very often interior designers say there is as much marital counselors as they are interior designers. And I always find it really helpful to work with a couple. For example, your situation sounds like one couple I worked with where she grew up in a suburban New Jersey neighborhood with lots of kids riding bikes in the streets, and he grew up in a Greek fishing village. Well, you couldn't get two more diverse right. backgrounds than that. But by going through the exercises that I have in my book, they were able to see that they did have certain core elements in common. For example, the love of nature, the idea of family being important, and the idea of community. So what I did was help them to look for a house that was on a wooded lot, but in a neighborhood where their son could also ride his bike kind of thing. And then also, when it came to the interior design of the home, thinking about putting in elements of family, be it family photos or really emphasizing places where family could gather. So rather than seeing poles apart, there's ways to highlight those common elements and include them in your home.
Well, there must be some reason that they fell in love and got married.
That's right. Right? That's
try
right.
to work with that stuff. Bree, is that helpful at all?
Yeah, it really is. It's going to take some good introspection to make that come together. We can do it.
That's what it's all about. Thanks for calling into Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Because I'm thinking about the various combinations of coupledom. I mean, sometimes there's the misanthrope and the extrovert. There's the, you know, the messy one, the neat one. And oftentimes there is an attraction between the two, and trying to reconcile what those differences are within the space of a shared home.
Right. Well, again, part of it is to become aware of that and then say, okay, given these two different styles, how do you accommodate each? For example, there's a couple I'm about to work with, and they mentioned just that problem as one of them. And, you know, what I pointed out to them is that partly reflects their styles of being in the world. You know, one person is more laid back and doesn't care about those things being organized. The other one is more concerned about those things. And they've, to some extent, been able to deal with that problem together. But then there are other ways to deal with it. The messy person gets to put everything in a cupboard where it doesn't have to be organized and just close the door. So it's helping them talking through how they take their different styles and combine that in a successful way.
Do you suggest that everyone have a place or a space that's theirs alone, their own sort of private space within a shared dwelling?
Right. Well, a private space is really important for all of us, and it can be in a dwelling or it can be even an outdoor place. Sometimes people have a certain place that they like to go and just think and be by themselves. You know, we know that in crowded places where you have kids who are trying to do homework and they're having to do that in where there's other activity around, that's a very hard thing. So in the ideal world, yes,
sure,
we would have a private space, but it's not always possible.
I mean, sometimes you just get a drawer, right, that's yours. You don't have to share with the rest of the world.
Right. But Everyone needs some place. Again, even if it isn't a place that they own, which would be ideal, right. It's a place that they carve out.
And that's Toby Israel, our guest today on Radio Time. She's a founder and leading practitioner in the field of design psychology. In fact, has a PhD in environmental psychology. She works as a consultant and a researcher and wrote a book called Someplace Like Home, Using Design Psychology to Create Ideal Places. Looks like just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Terry from Upper Black Eddy to join us. Terry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Toby, I am thrilled. You know, I must say, if you get a headache tonight, it's me trying to climb into your brain and know everything that you know. I'm thrilled. I had not an environment as a child that I would wish to recreate on any scale in terms of the immediate home. So what I have done is I have recreated a small space from my public library as a child. The child's reading room as a little girl was on a second level of the library with a very low ceiling, with multi-paned windows, with little wooden dividers, you know, making little tiny, like 15 little window panes out of one large piece of glass. And that is the space I have recreated. And it is a dream. It is the place to go for absolute peace and restoration. It is my private little space, and anyone from the family can go there, but it does not convey the same meaning to anyone except to me, and therefore, regardless of who else is in that space, there is a specialness to it.
Well, that's interesting. Let me get to Toby Israel to respond, Terry, to your story. Interesting.
That's a wonderful story, and what you've done is just so positive. I have to say that my mother lived across the street from the library, and she also talks about that library as her home away from home. Mm. So it kind of goes back to what I was saying before about a public place possibly being the place that someone feels more connected to than their private home, especially if that own home has some uncomfortable parts to it, aspects to it.
And Terry, thanks for calling in to Radio Times. And I like the fact that she said that other people are invited into this private space. But what it means to her is unique, is that for them, obviously, it's one experience. But for her, it's her own personal experience with this particular room. Did you want to read something from your book there?
Well, it reminded me of a segment in my book where I had given a talk and a Seattle architect heard me speak and then wrote to me later, and he said, "Several days prior to your talk, I was hired to design a house for a client who wanted to build a stone house with lots of references to castle details. I did a quick design for him for talking paper, but missed the mark as far as he was concerned. He was rather cool. After your program, I met with my client, and I started asking him about his upbringing with lots of questions about why he wanted a building that seemed so incongruous to our region. He told me he grew up in Portland, Oregon, and described neighborhoods that I was familiar with, which led to even more confusion on my part. Maybe he didn't really want a castle. I showed him some historical references. One was in a book about shingle-style homes, which are mingled with many of the fine, older craftsman-style homes in Portland. Even though he worked in Europe and made references to castles there, I doubted their influence over him as an adult could lead to such a strong desire. But I knew of a house that had some of the characteristics of what he was looking for. It was really a shingle-style house with stone masonry walls up to the second floor. I had a book with an illustration of the house. His jaw just about hit the tabletop. This house had the turret and the stone and the Romanesque arches. But what was the key was that this house was located across the street from where he attended elementary school in Portland. He talked with great animation about how he spent hours gazing out of the windows of his school admiring this house. After that moment, we absolutely clicked. I came back with a revised design in a genre similar, and it was immediately accepted. Your illustrations of how designers work are interesting, but the real power to me is in understanding my clients.
Well, that's fascinating. And so he was a kid in school just daydreaming, obviously, looking out the window at this building, and then as an adult, that's what he wanted to live in.
Right.
I like that. Let me, Terry, thanks for the call. Let me get Fran from Paoli to join us. Hi, Fran. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Marty, once again, a great program.
Thank you.
It's funny that this should all come up at this time because we're in the process of, my family is in the process of a possible move, and my husband and I have been talking about the neighborhood and the type of environment that we want to be for our next home. And, you know, I keep describing this place where, you know, there's sidewalks, which there's where we are right now, there's not many of, and you could walk to town, and
sure,
there's a nice downtown area, and there's a park around the corner, and the library is close, and wouldn't that be great if we could pretty much walk to everything instead of always getting in the car, and the school and the church are close by, and work's not too far away, and you know, this whole thing, and he keeps on saying to me, he just said to me the other night, you're describing your parents' house. And it totally, he's like, you didn't realize that? And it totally didn't connect until he said that. And I thought, but of course that is, you know. I mean, I don't
sure
want the house itself, but I want the things that were all accessible to me as a child. And so it's just really interesting that you should say that. And the funny thing about it all is I'm a very neat person, and my mother always had a sloppy house. And as I'm talking to you right now, my dining room, which looks like a bomb hit it, because I have all this project that's going on as I'm listening to the radio. And growing up, the dining room in my house growing up was always like the dump all, you know, the place where everything got stored until you knew what to do with it. So it's
a family tradition.
Come back.
Exactly. Fran, thanks for calling into Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a great show.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Any comments on that, Toby?
Well, it's interesting that you talk about a place that's walkable, a place with a town center. In fact, Marty and I were just talking about each living in a community that has that kind of feeling to it. And yes, it is something that we had more of in days gone by. And what we hear now is so much about suburban sprawl and McMansions being created where you have to drive from your house to any kind of town center. And in opposition to that, we're seeing smart growth movement come along, traditional neighborhood design, TND, new urbanism, not so big house. There are a groundswell of thinkers in the world of design who are trying to come up with another way to think about not just home but community overall, to connect people with their place. And particularly Andre Stuani, who's kind of the darling of the international planning world, spearheading new urbanism, particularly Duane and his wife Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg, have made real inroads in the home building industry. I think the Times reported a year or so ago that, oh, well, they only had affected 10% of the housing market in the United States. Well,
that's a lot of sizable.
Yeah, push. I mean, that's a tremendous amount.
But the idea is to create communities and build houses with porches. I mean, the kinds of things that the people remember and worked for.
Where people and place are connected, where you actually see people, bump into people, have a sense of community that's supported by the design of the place. And I think I was talking the other day and saying, well, really, home builders, especially the large home builders, need to be thinking about this in a genuine way. It's almost like I think of the car industry, you know, people first started talking about having hybrid cars and saving energy and so on and so forth. They were seen as the fringe, okay? But Toyota took it seriously, and now we have Toyota grabbing the market and Ford and GM trying to catch up. Well, in the same way, some of these huge home-building conglomerates build huge communities with no thought and just really consider the bottom line. Well, there's going to be a huge backlash, and they're going to find themselves lost, as Toyota did.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back with Toby Israel. We're talking about design psychology. And after the break, I do want to talk about families that lost their home from Hurricane Katrina. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times, about the Hamas victory in the Palestinian elections and how it's affecting the Middle East. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Next time on Day to Day.
After you've ponied back.
A dance troupe for well-rounded women.
I had never seen fat girls move like that before, and I just thought it was amazing. And my first thought was, I want to be one.
5, 6, 7, 8.
Challenging the modern notion of what it means to be a dancer.
Big moves next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll look at a neighborhood grassroots group that helps elderly people stay in their own homes. Also, a group of African-American women aims to clean up hip-hop. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now. Today at noon on WHYY. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, Toby Israel is our guest. She's a environmental psychologist, a design psychologist, and we're talking about how the memories of early childhood homes and neighborhood can help us create and think about the kinds of productive and comfortable living and working environments that we want to live with and live in today. Her book is called Someplace Like Home, Using Design Psychology to Create Ideal Places. We got a full bank of calls here, but as we're talking about home and all this sense of nostalgia and memory about home, I'm also thinking about the thousands of people living in New Orleans that lost their homes because of Hurricane Katrina last late summer, early September. And also this poignant desire that they have to go back home. And for some of those people, there is nothing there. I mean, there's just a sort of a blank piece of lawn or macadam,
right?
And yet this desire to go back home is so strong. Do you understand that?
Sure. I mean, what's there is the memory of home, the psychological experience of home, rather than just the physical place. And when you look at what's gone on there, part of it is that so many neighborhoods in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, there's just an extremely strong social network. So part of it is wanting to recreate that social network. And then also in relation to environmental family tree genealogy, there are some families that go back for generations and generations there. So they have a history, a memory in that sense
right.
as well.
I mean, many of them feeling, of course, homeless and out of control. What's so difficult is that they're not in charge of going back home, which has got to add another layer of stress.
Right. And if you go back to the idea that the house is a symbol of self, then the reality is if you lose your house, you lose your sense of self and you feel vulnerable and you feel lost. So part of what's important in rebuilding is not only to rebuild the physical homes for people, but also to rebuild the neighborhoods in a way that brings back those same people, those same communities that live together. And also to give people a say about what they want in the rebuilding is vitally important.
So in a way, I mean, using New Orleans as an example, then try to recreate the kind of architecture that in the Ninth Ward, for instance, which got so devastated. I think they call it a shotgun house. But
right.
These small wooden houses have been there, and I've seen them.
Right, and that may be important to people. And part of it is just asking people, bringing people together in a kind of visioning process that gets people to say what it is that they do really want.
And certainly the World Trade Center, when that went down, of course, now we're talking about huge buildings and a very urbanized, very sort of concrete neighborhood. How do you see that as a tragedy of home?
Right. Well, I see it as a psychology of place because, again, it wasn't just that the building, you know, physical building was hit. It was what it meant to people across the country and culturally and in a psychological sense that really this place has been devastated. It was an attack on us as a country, as a people. And so in rebuilding, those involved need to think not just about the physical rebuilding of a large tower, bigger, better, we're going to show them kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But think about what's going to heal the country's wounds through this symbolic ground.
So kind of home building as memorial. I mean, then that, of course, everyone has their own sort of memory experience of a particular kind of place. And it seems impossible to try to make everybody happy about
that's
how you
true.
Would recreate.
And everybody has a different opinion
of course.
About what should be built there. I know, you know, I was briefly knew some people who were working directly in the project, and they asked me what I would do. I would build I would go down rather than go up. I would have made a very open space, almost like you have at the Louvre in Paris, and then create an atrium or an aviary with doves of peace from all over the world. Well, you know, that's just another one of
not on that
many
expensive piece of property,
yeah,
right?
Not, you know, everybody has a different opinion. But part of you know, what I've wondered is right now, what's driving that land is Silverstein, you know, and kind of someone with the money, when really he has no pressure upon him to in any way think about the psychological need of people. He just, you know, is really pressed for profit. And then I think about, well, eminent domain has become a very hot issue, the idea that we can take people's land, the government can take people's land, and supposedly for the public good, and then the fear is that developers will take that land away from people. Well, why can't we do the reverse? City or state by eminent domain take it from a developer and thereby see it as put towards public good in the psychological sense, not just in terms of profit. So, you know, again, everybody has an opinion. It's a very complex situation.
Well, I'll tell you what, we got a full bank of calls here. Let me get back to our callers. And where are we? Janelle? Is that where we are? Okay, Janelle calling us from Ambler. Hi, go ahead, you're in Radio Times.
Yes, I wanted to mention how when I was a child, we moved every 2 years, and the only consistency in my life was a cabin that my grandfather rented up in the Adirondacks, and we went there every year. And ever since then, I've always been attracted to any kind of open space, wood beam, wood smell, every architect from Frank Lloyd Wright up to, you know, a log cabin. And when the previous caller talked about the messy dining table, I had a flashback to my grandfather's table in the cabin, strewn with all his papers. And I've always felt a restlessness ever since, a search for that sort of a home. And it all makes very great sense to me now, so I definitely have to read the book.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I mean, what I always find interesting is that when you begin to think about your childhood, the more you remember about it. I mean, it's the process of beginning to think about it brings up all these interesting memories. Any comment to Janelle's observations about herself?
Well, I'm really glad that you mentioned a grandparent's home, because when I do these exercises with people again and again, I particularly see that grandparents' houses come out. And what's been speculated, really, is that grandparents' houses are often the favorite houses because they were the places where both the child and the parent get a break, because the child is there getting unconditional positive regard, all the love
attention
and ice cream that they want, and the parent gets a chance to relax and not be responsible for the child the whole time. So it's a place, grandparents' places are very often places remembered with exceptional fondness. So it's not just that people recreate their own childhood home, but that of their grandparents perhaps as well. So that fits with what you're saying.
Janelle, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. She mentioned the fact that she lived in many different homes, in many different houses, and that's certainly true for Americans. I don't know what the typical number of homes is that an American lives in, but I know we are a very mobile society.
Yes. And it's interesting to me, again, I have had people come up to me and say, you know, I was an Army brat, and we moved time after time after time. And then they either say one of two things, and now I have my own house and I'm never moving, or,
right,
and now I love to move. You know, so people react to that in different ways. But I think in terms of being a very mobile society, what is missing when that happens is this sense of connection to family who may be nearby, the kind of thing that my parents or grandparents had. And so, for example, friends may be a new connection, or other community groups may be the place that you meet. But that points further to why these very human places, walkable communities and so on, are so important to us.
For all those connective reasons. I wonder, too, whether someone that has lived in a lot of houses, and obviously people don't always do the same thing, whether in trying to design or live in the house they have today, that they borrow sort of something from each of the house that they've grown up in and incorporated in where they live.
That's now a great way to do it. You know, for some people, especially if you're feeling, well, you're not quite here and you're not quite there, thinking about, well, of all the places that I lived in, what are the pieces that were the fondest parts for me in bringing those into the home? Yes.
Let me get to Laura from Harleysville to join us this morning on Radio Times. Hi, Laura. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I got married 4 months ago, and my husband and I did not live together before we got married. And the house that I lived in with my parents, I had lived there for 26 years. I have had the most difficult time adjusting to my new life. I think because my roots were so strong in my parents' home. And the thing that's really hard now, too, is that they're an hour and a half away. I'm sure that I know the answer to your question, but I'm hoping that one day I'm going to feel like this is my home, too.
And can you describe your home for us, Laura, and then we'll hear from Toby Israel.
Well, right now we are renting a home, and it's a two-bedroom, and we have a huge kitchen with a 12-seat dining room table in the kitchen, which is wonderful because, as you said earlier, that's where everyone gathers.
Right.
Our house is great, and we have two animals. We have a dog and a cat, and I love my husband to death. I am just having such a hard time adjusting, and we're saving money right now so that we can buy a home of our own. And my husband is 32, and he's moved 22 times in his life.
Oh, interesting.
I'm sorry?
No, I was going to say, that's interesting. I mean, just talking about how couples have different experiences that they bring together into one home.
Right. And I said to him when we're looking at homes, and I said to him, I want to find a place that's ours. I don't want, you know, a row home. I want a single home that I can walk all the way around and say, this is mine, and this is where we're going to raise our kids, and, you know, this is what I want. And he doesn't see that. And in that respect, we're having a very hard time, and I think he's conceding to me that he feels like, okay, this is what you want, it's important to you, and it is, because I don't want my kids to feel like they don't belong anywhere.
Well, that's really interesting. You put a lot on the table for us, Laura. Let me just see what Toby Israel is thinking about.
Well, part of it is it's not so much that you're adjusting to something different than you've had for such a long time by living in your parents' home. It's that your husband's coming, it sounds like, from a completely different experience where he's been mobile and not used to, in a sense, nesting, because that's what you're talking about, is really creating. You want to create a nest. Mm-hmm. You're used to coming from a nest. He's not used to having a nest. So, you know, in a way, I often say, or it's often said, that the relationship dynamic is played out in the house too, because what you're kind of trying to come to terms with, it sounds like, is, well, what does it mean to be married? You know, what does it mean to join two households together to form a new nest? And part of coming, you know, you didn't say anything negative. I didn't hear too much negative about your
sounds
physical
like a nice
home.
Living
yeah.
room, kitchen,
right?
And
I was kind of surprised that you said so many positive things about the house. So it's really sounds like both of you coming to terms with what's your vision of home, what's your vision of nest, and then that's where the comfort comes from. Mm-hmm. It doesn't sound so much like it's the physical home that's the problem.
And maybe just the newness, as you say, Laura, of a relationship. If you haven't lived together, there's a lot of stuff you have to figure out.
You know what's funny? Before we got married, my husband was pushing me to move in with him, and I said, no, 63% of couples that live together end up in divorce. I don't want to do that. And he said, fine. And you're right. I love our home. If we could buy this house that we're renting, we would, because we're so happy here. And I think that a lot of it is the newness, because I'm not used to this.
Sure.
And my commute now, I'm still working at the place where I worked when I was at my parents' house, so my commute now is an hour, and that's kind of hard for me, too. And as much as my stuff is here, I had such a hard time packing up my things at my house because I didn't want to leave anything, because I felt like it was all me and I had to bring it with me. And I know that that's not true. It was just how I felt. And my husband was fine with it. He said, whatever, you know, just bring it. But, yes, our home is a very happy home, and I very much am happy being married. But it is a big adjustment that I just
sure.
was not expecting.
Sure. Well, as I say, Laura, I think you're very insightful about yourself, and sounds like you're on to a pretty exciting adventure. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Welcome. Anything else you want to add to that, Toby?
No, it just sounds like you're in transition.
Right. Right. And transition is all those things that she described. Mm-hmm. Let me get to Danielle from Chester to join us. Hi, Danielle. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're
I
welcome.
Love this show. And I have a comment. I absolutely agree with what you have to say about grandparents, because as other callers were talking about it, I have nothing but positive memories of growing up and staying sometimes with my grandpa and grandma Callahan. And it's all the senses. I'm an artist now, and I really recognize when I'm looking at my garden, I want to plant ferns and Lily of the Valleys, because that's what they had.
Sure.
And I'm wondering also, you talk about, I think it's a sense of safety and comfort, and also I'm wondering how many memories are about attention. I'm one of six siblings, and when I'd stay there, I'd get more attention. So I think that has a lot to do with it. But I actually had a question, and I wanted to know if you have any stories about our sense of touch, because again, as an artist and someone who spent a lot of times with younger children, I realize as an adult, you know, I don't really touch things, and I've gone from being a 2D artist to a 3D, and I'm working with tree bark texture, and wanting to incorporate that into our home. So I'm just wondering, aside from the visuals like messy versus sure. lean and clean, the importance of texture and touch as adults when we try to create a comforting environment.
No, that's a great question. Toby Israel?
Well, again, when I take people through the what I call the environmental guided fantasy, I have them not only look at what they are imagining around them, but smell it, touch the environment, taste it, and so on. And that seems to really enrich their vision of a place, not literal vision, but sure. In their imagination, what the place is. I guess if you translate that into home, well, where is the place that you touch? Quite frankly, it's the bedroom,
of
you
course.
Know? So if you're not thinking about a space as totally sensory, then you're not going to have a bedroom where it's going to be very pleasant to touch. So part of thinking about all the senses in terms of design or design psychology is to recognize that that's an important piece of a design.
Danielle, thanks for calling into Radio Times. We're nearly out of time, and it's interesting to me that we didn't hear from any men in the audience. Mm-hmm. And I wonder whether this is a different experience for men and women, of course, speaking very broadly and large stereotypes, but have you found that to be true?
Well, one of the things is research seems to show that it's generally the woman who makes the decisions about home design, home decor, and men, at least in a traditional sense, are often, you know, looking at the garage and the shop and that kind of thing. Whether that's just, you know, something that we've been socialized to behave with those roles, I can't say, but certainly women are seen as having a lot of the buying power when it comes to decor.
Well, Toby Israel, thank you so much for joining
thank
us today
you,
on
Marty.
Radio Times. And she's an environmental psychologist, design psychologist. Her book is entitled Someplace Like Home, Using Design Psychology to Create Ideal Places. Devorah Lissick, Alan Tu, Susan Greenbaum produce Radio Times. Scotty Williams, the engineer for today's edition of the program. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can leave us an email there. Find out about podcasts of the program. And there's other information about the program as well. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware, and worldwide at whyy.org.